This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The childcare workforce in Massachusetts is 12% smaller than it was before the pandemic, according to new research from the University of California, Berkeley. And for parents trying to find care, there is a frustrating conundrum. So childcare workers are leaving the industry because they earn too little, while the cost of putting your child in care keeps rising. So what is going on? Carrie Young is WBUR's senior education reporter, and she's a part of the team that has just released the first two stories in a five-part series on childcare in Massachusetts. She joins us from the newsroom to go behind the headlines. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So yesterday, the first story, you've got voices of childcare workers trying to make ends meet. And the team actually spoke to a number of childcare workers for that. Tell me what you guys heard that struck you or surprised you the most.
Yeah, and it's important to mention that I did work with a team. It was very much a team effort. Yasmin Emmer and Max Larkin. And I called probably about a dozen current and former childcare workers for this, who I am just so grateful that they were open to sharing their stories with us like they did. We ended up running about 8 of those stories. And, you know, there was a lot in those conversations that I was expecting, you know, from pre-reporting and background interviews and that kind of thing. The biggest thing was the low pay and the struggle around that. I also knew that most people in this line of work are incredibly dedicated and really love their jobs. Now, to answer your question, I think the thing that surprised me the most was just hearing about how gut-wrenching the decision to leave was, or even just considering leaving. Some of them hadn't are still in their jobs, rather, but might be considering leaving. And, you know, I heard a lot of talk about guilt over even having that idea, or even just wanting better pay so that they could provide better for their family and make that leap. You know, and then in addition to that, I think there were a couple of just interactions that stuck with me. And this one between Yasmin and a teacher named Kimberly Artez was one of them.
I have a MED, Masters of Education. Then I have an MS degree. Then I have a bachelor's degree, and that is in human services. And last but not least, I have an associate's degree in early childhood education.
As somebody with 4 degrees, including 2 master's degrees, what is the highest annual income you've ever made?
Between 36 and 38.
A year.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Kimberly's experience, you know, it was something we knew, but, you know, when you hear it all together like that, with how many degrees she had, how much education she had, and yet, you know, her pay might have been $18, $20 an hour. And that's for a lead teacher like her. For non-lead teachers, so assistants, other employees in childcare, those rates are typically lower, around $15 an hour.
So it strikes me, you're talking about people feeling torn because they care about the kids, they care about the work. And we do know change sometimes can be hard on kids. Do we have a sense of the effects of turnover on kids' development?
So yes and no. That's a story we'll dig into on Thursday, I believe. Gabriella Emanuel, our health reporter, is taking a look at that. And she talked to several researchers who said that, you know, what we do know is that high-quality interactions between adults and kids play a really big role in brain development, especially when it comes to things like developing skills for future learning. And so high-quality interactions means seeing someone you know every day. And even if there is a little bit of turnover, it's not a constant thing. And so those direct lines, I don't know if we have those yet, but we do know how important high-quality, regular interactions are for kids.
Sounds like it also helps explain the 4 degrees that the previous speaker
right,
had.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's not just babysitting. That's one thing we heard a lot from a lot of these workers was that, you know, it takes a lot of skill, it takes classes, education, to be able to do this job well and get kids started off on a good path. And that's something that's not always recognized by the larger public.
So let's touch on this conundrum, low pay for workers, high costs for families. Max Larkin touched on that this morning's story. Just break it down quickly for us.
Yeah, so we got this question a lot when we were pitching and editing story one. You know, those provider voices, when you hear it in succession like that, we kind of felt like, you know, after so many discussions, it kind of begged this question of, okay, well, if employees get paid so little, why then is tuition so expensive?
$20,000 for an infant in Massachusetts.
And that's the average. It can be more. I mean, so yeah, it's a lot. A lot of parents have told us it feels like a second rent payment, a second mortgage payment. And so, you know, why? If it's not going to people that are doing this job, then why? And so the short answer to this question, as Max laid out for us today, was that in order to safely provide care and high-quality education for these young learners, there needs to be a lot of adults in a room. And while those adults may not be paid very well, it adds up when there's several of them. And then you need someone to coordinate all of that care. And then there's building maintenance, rent, insurance, things like that. And so the other thing, you know, there are these costs that we expect, and that's it's something that the public school system has to pay as well. But unlike the public school system, the reasons that parents are feeling this pinch so acutely in childcare is because there's very little in the way of government assistance to support that kind of learning. And it's almost entirely on the parents, depending on your income. So, you know, when you look at the two different systems, they're hugely different in that way, and that's where that money factor comes in.
So what you're paying, for example, in taxes serves to subsidize educating your child if you're in the K-12 public schools, but not for early education and care.
Almost not at all, depending on your income level, yeah.
Okay, so you went into this report. This was interesting to me. You went in planning to write one story, and now we have a series of five. So what happened? You must have uncovered so much.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like what I was just saying of like, well, we were talking about this and that begged the question of, well, what about? And it was just a series of those kinds of moments. And we went on and on and on, you know. And so I think what ended up happening was we were like, you know, there's so many people who are struggling in this system between parents and workers and businesses even, you know, who are having trouble keeping employees when they're having childcare issues that we decided to focus on the labor market. Not to say that there isn't more to discuss here, but that's kind of where we ended with this series, that we could follow a story arc that made sense and also follow some of the important numbers and reports that have come out on that recently.
So what did you have to not cover that you kind of wanted to? I mean, we always make choices, right? We can't do everything. So what were some of the other subjects that piqued your interest but you couldn't cover in this series?
Yeah, a lot ended up on the cutting room floor with this. So, you know, like I mentioned, we do know and have heard quite a bit from parents that there is a huge struggle out there to pay for, find affordable care, that kind of thing. We've heard a lot in response from social media. We've done a couple call-outs, but we're trying to figure out how to maybe put a post together about some of those responses we've heard back, just because that's such an important piece of this puzzle. But could have talked to parents for a long time if we had the time. The other thing that I wanted to dig into more, and we ended up not being able to, was talking about, it was something we saw especially sort of in the early days of the pandemic, the She Session.
Yeah.
As it was known, nationwide, 1.7 million women left the workforce and stayed out between January 2020 and October of 2021. And I remember talking to a lot of moms at that time and, you know, just hearing them talk about how torn they were about, yes, this is the right financial decision for my family right now, but just feeling like they've almost lost a part of themselves by leaving their job behind that they might have enjoyed. And then also, we didn't touch at all on nannies or au pairs and some of the working conditions related to those types of jobs. So, you know, I could talk about this for hours. My family could confirm that for you, but but we had to leave it somewhere. So,
but you did bring us a little sample of what you've been hearing from parents today, right?
Yes. Yeah. We've heard so much. I've made some different phone calls, followed up with a couple parents that have written in over social media. And the overwhelming theme that we've heard from them, you know, is that childcare is budget busting, and that it's hard to find quality care on your budget. Like, it can take a long time. And I think that's what we're going to hear from one parent coming up. This is just a sample of two folks who talked to us.
And I searched for about 5 months, you know, emailing and calling and, you know, doing whatever I could in order to try to find a provider in our budget who actually had space for an infant.
They ask me for more than I get in 1 week in my paycheck. in the Boston area, it's very, very, very high.
So who we heard there was Lamia. She's a mom of two from Revere. And then April McCarthy, she's also a mom of two, and she's from Chelmsford.
So we know that in policy, right, childcare is definitely having a moment. Carrie, the Biden administration has proposed subsidizing childcare. Here's a little bit of Joe Biden from the State of the Union last year.
That low and middle income families will pay no more than 7% of their income for high quality care for children up to the age of five. The most hard-pressed working families won't have to spend a dime.
So, you know, the reporting this week I know shows that is not where we are now, but it also doesn't seem like that vision is going to go anywhere right now. Is that correct?
On the federal level, it does seem to be on ice, probably. But that doesn't mean that there's not a lot going on here in Massachusetts. There's actually quite a bit of movement here locally. So the big things to mention in the state anyway are one of the biggest ones, rather, is the Common Start bill. It proposed some pretty bold ideas in comparison to what we've heard really in the past couple years in the different legislative sessions. But it proposed a similar thing about the no family paying more than 7% of their income on childcare. And there were also some other guarantees built in there, like bedrock funding, you know, that providers could expect to come in from the state. And also having a better baseline for how much subsidized care actually costs providers. That also stalled, but in May, there was a pared-down version of that bill that was introduced. So that effort continued, and it is still unclear if that's going to pass. I know we're pretty solidly into budget discussion season on Beacon Hill, which I understand really doesn't leave room for many other debates there. So, but even if none of that ends up passing, I know the childcare field isn't going home empty-handed. And the reason I say that is because all three of the state budget proposals for next year include some significant new investments in childcare, around $300 million extra dollars in funding. So it's definitely going to help relieve some of the pressure.
All right. So, Carrie, take us out by telling us about the next piece in the series.
Yeah. So the next piece in the series comes from Yasmeen Emmer. She took a look at the role that businesses are starting to play in at least helping to close the gap in childcare affordability. You know, many realized after the pandemic that in order to keep employees, they need to provide good benefits, and childcare is a really enticing one. So here's a tiny preview of what we'll hear from that story.
If you want to keep employees, you know, and if you want these working moms to stay, then you have to give them support, and that's just how it is.
Thanks, Carrie. All right, so that's what we can look forward to. I know there are actually five going on this week. We'll look forward to all of them. That is Carrie Young, senior education reporter at WBUR, with a look at the new series on childcare from the newsroom. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You've probably noticed that your mornings have gotten a little louder as migrating birds make their way back to New England after wintering as far south as the tip of South America. Now, ornithologists call that morning blast of bird song the dawn chorus. I don't know about you, but I know it well. But that chorus is actually getting quieter. A landmark study in science finds North America has lost about 30% of its bird life since 1970. That's about 3 billion birds. WBUR's Walter Wuthman reports on a unique audio project trying to recreate what we've lost.
The birds come here hungry and tired, sometimes flying for days without food or water. On this cool spring evening, as the sun sets over the Great Meadows National Wildlife Refuge in Sudbury, some of the newest arrivals are putting on a show.
We have tree swallows out over the marsh. These little tiny gnats are delicious, probably, for them. They just... Oh, that's a titmouse. That was redwing.
Joan Walsh is the chair of field ornithology for Mass Audubon. She scans the marsh through a pair of binoculars.
Yeah, it's an osprey. Oh, isn't that fantastic? I haven't seen an osprey yet this year.
It's a peaceful scene that repeats every year. But these spring migrations back to New England aren't what they used to be. Walsh remembers watching migrating flocks of red knots in the 1980s.
It could have rivaled any nature documentary that you watch about the wildebeests going across the Serengeti. Now it's down to just a fraction, and it's a tragedy.
Scientists calculate North America has lost about 30% of its bird life in the past half century because of habitat degradation, urbanization, and the use of toxic pesticides. It's a massive loss, but in some ways, it's almost invisible. Each year, the flocks are a little thinner and the birdsong a little quieter. So how do you make people aware that populations are collapsing before they're all gone? It's a question that's haunted another naturalist, 3,000 miles away in Norfolk, England.
Hi, I'm Dr. Simon Butler. I'm an associate professor in ecology at the University of East Anglia.
Butler says he was out walking his dog one morning, listening to the dawn chorus, when he had a thought. He realized he could use the same historic bird count data that shows population decline to reconstruct how different places would have sounded 5, 10, or 20 years ago. He and his research team pulled population data from more than 200,000 sites across North America and Europe. They started matching records of individual birds with audio recordings of their songs.
So we started off with an empty 5-minute sound file, and then we took the first species in that list that had been monitored at that site. And for every individual counted of that species, we inserted a clip of that species recording, song recording into our soundscape. So if there were 5 American robins recorded, for example, we'd insert 5 clips of American robin song. And then we'd build that up for all of the individuals of all of the different species at that site in that year to build a composite soundscape that broadly represented what it might have sounded like standing next to the surveyors as they were undertaking their survey at that site.
Citizen scientists at Great Meadows National Wildlife Refuge in Sudbury have been doing bird counts in this area for decades. Butler took that data and reconstructed what this site may have sounded like 25 years ago. Butler and his team analyzed patterns between all 200,000 sites in North America and across Europe. They found that overall, these soundscapes are now quieter and more homogenous than they were 2 decades ago.
And what we're finding over time is that nature's orchestra, we're losing players from that, but we're also losing instruments. And although we won't necessarily detect that those particular things have gone, those particular players have gone, the quality of the overall sound is reducing. And that's what we're trying to measure with this.
Mass Audubon's Joan Walsh was moved when she heard Butler's soundscapes. She says it gave her new perspective on just how much we've lost.
It's like taking the Crayola crayons and just leaving you with the palette of grays instead of letting you have all the colors. It's taking the orchestra and removing the piccolo and the flute and the bass. And we deserve just so much more than that.
Walsh thinks it's not too late to reverse the loss. She says we've done it before. The federal government's ban on the toxic pesticide DDT, following Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring, helped save bald eagles from the brink of extinction. But Walsh says we're running out of such silver bullets.
A lot of the challenges that animals face now is a general degradation, right? It's the inching away, the chipping away of habitat. And those things are difficult to be able to counteract.
Habitat preservation is key, but there are other things people can do too. Lights in skyscrapers and office buildings can be turned off during peak migration periods. Many birds migrate at night, and building lights can confuse them and throw them off track. Boston had a lights-out program in the early 2000s, but it fizzled out. Walsh thinks the city should bring it back. She says we need to restore these lost soundscapes.
The baby who's just being born today in Boston, in Methuen, in Deerfield, anywhere in this state, deserves to have that in their future.
Rachel Carson warned us of a silent spring in the 1960s. Her book inspired an environmental movement. If we don't make changes again, that silent spring may yet come to pass.
That was WBUR's Walter Wuthman. Xanthochrome. Now that might sound like a word straight out of science fiction, and its uses might too. It can encourage cell regeneration, block the entire spectrum of sunlight, it's an antioxidant, it rehydrates skin, I could go on. But it is not Science fiction is actually the key ingredient for a skincare startup out of Northeastern University called C-Spire. The founders are taking what they've learned in the lab known as the cephalopod team, studying marine life with color-changing abilities and applying it to beauty and the skincare world. Joining us in studio now, Leila Dharavi, Chief Technology Officer of C-Spire and Assistant Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Northeastern University, and Camille Martin, CEO of C-Spire and part of the cephalopod team in Layla's lab. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so Leila, what is a cephalopod team?
A cephalopod team is just a group of really eager researchers who are interested and fascinated by the beautiful color-changing properties of marine animals called cephalopods. And so those include octopus, squid, and cuttlefish.
Okay, and Camille, how did you wind up as a member of said cephalopod team?
Well, I came to Northeastern University for pursuing my PhD in chemistry, and I was looking for something that could be translated into a project that I can use in the beauty industry. And so once I met with Leila, I had an open mind, and there was a lot of synergy between what we were learning about these amazing animals and potential applications in the beauty space, even though at the time seemed a little bit far-reaching, but through a lot of work together, we were able to map out something that is really amazing today.
So, Leila, when Camille first says, hey, how about skincare business? Was your reaction, I'm sorry, what? Or was it, yeah, that tracks?
Oh, yeah. We were definitely, this is it. You know, this is exactly where we want to go. And this is exactly the industry that we want to transform, because it is an industry that is desperately in need of new materials.
Why?
So we were all about it.
Why?
Why? Because the standard active ingredients and chemicals that are used in over-the-counter skincare products have been kind of grandfathered in over the past several decades, and a lot of them are currently under reevaluation by the FDA for being safe and effective for skin and also for the environment. And so there is a significant need to generate new raw materials that are going to hit these milestones of being safe for skin and safe for the environment. And we believe we cracked it with our bio-inspired material here.
All right. And this word bio-inspired is important, I know. So Camille, let's start with this idea of xanthochrome. What is it?
Xanthochrome, it is a multifunctional anti-aging compound that is inspired by the color-changing animals in the cephalopod family, so octopus, squid, and cuttlefish. The name comes from its chemical origin, and chrome is a word that describes bright and rich color. And so the nature of the compound is a really brilliant, bright pigment that we have been repurposing as an active ingredient with more than just aesthetic presence, but also functionality. And so xanthochrome is what I consider a breakthrough ingredient. It's almost like wearing the same shirt to three different places, depending on what you're looking for. You're looking for a rich pigment. You're looking for a broad spectrum sun filter, an anti-aging compound, an antioxidant, even a moisturizer. You can find that all with a single ingredient. And so that's so amazing.
So cephalopods have been around, you know, really long time. And this was there. Mm-hmm. So how is this like a magical new thing?
Later? So it's interesting because the entire sort of field of, let's see, cephalopod discovery and chemistry and biology and all the different types of sciences associated with it has kind of historically, it has kind of overlooked the pigmentation in the skin itself. And so we decided to really focus and take a very rigorous bioanalytical chemistry approach to actually identifying and quantifying what is exactly in the skin, what is contributing to the color. And we found these molecules, and these molecules are very interesting, and they're metabolites of amino acids, so they're naturally derived, and they're photostable in these animals. And so we, like I said, we think we landed on something really, really unique for this industry.
Okay, so Camille, we did a story, I don't know, maybe it was a year ago now, maybe a little longer, on horseshoe crabs and how blood from horseshoe crabs is used in a range of research and the real environmental threat that can create both to the crabs and to the way crabs participate in the ecosystem. as I understand it, you are not actually extracting anything from cephalopods. You have recreated this in a lab. Is that right?
That is 100% correct. And so initially, we had studied the material from the animal source, and we were really excited about what we were finding. And we thought this could be a sustainability play, repurposing waste, because we were finding this in materials that are often discarded in the processing of calamari. However, when I started to call different restaurant to see what do you do with this post-use material, they thought I was with the environmental working agency, and they were like, absolutely not, call our corporate. Coupled with going into the beauty industry to various trade shows, we found that as soon as you said animal derived, it was like a big red stop sign. And so we put our heads down, we went into the lab and started to figure out, can we make a bioidentical version of what's found in these animals? And we were able to do that. And so now we're able to process and scale this to be able to support our product launch without having to rely on the natural resources and disrupting those marine ecosystems.
All right, so two things. One, if I had had a bingo card, calamari waste from restaurants in the cosmetic conversation would not have been on it. That was a little bit of a surprise. So, Layla, I'll turn to you. I think you know culturally there's a lot of pushback to, for example, genetically modified organisms, doing that in food products, et cetera. So this is purely synthetic. How do we really know it's safe? How do we really know that it will not have some other unexpected environmental impact or ecosystem impact by what's in the compounds?
That is an excellent question. And to be honest, we have such a unique approach in the CSpire team as being both PhD chemists to be able to design a series of really, really, really rigorous and also industry-approved standard protocols and studies to be able to actually prove this empirically. And we have done so over the past year in CSpire, being able to show that this is not an endocrine disruptor, which is a primary concern of a lot of over-the-counter active ingredients in skincare.
What does any of that mean, endocrine disruptor?
Endocrine is the hormonal regulation system. So a lot of what's being found today is that some of these active ingredients, actually, once you put them on the skin and once you put them on daily, they actually can penetrate through your skin and actually go into your bloodstream and introduce some dysregulation into your hormonal system. So it can actually cause pretty significant systemic problems internally.
And a year of trial is enough to be sure that that is not the
That's
case
right.
with this synthetic material.
So you have industry approved and industry standard testing protocols, which we have been able to adapt and adopt inside of the company. And we've been able to, like I said, empirically prove that our material is safe for a lot of these studies for humans.
All right, so let's shift to the business side of this now. Layla, your chief technology officer, Camille, your chief executive officer. We have two women of color launching a new business in the cosmetics industry in Boston. I think my first question for you is this a friendly, supportive environment here in Boston to launch a business like this, Camille?
And I can say from my experience being a PhD student, then translating into a business leader, there was a lot of support within the Greater Boston community. In fact, our very first investors, which is The Engine, which is a venture fund built by MIT, very early on in our discovery of our compound and being able to map out how we would commercialize this, we got a lot of helpful resources from this organization.
We had Katie Ray on the show yesterday.
Amazing.
Oh,
yeah,
awesome.
Perfect.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. So she was one of our initial champions. And I can say it's been a waterfall effect. Since then, we've been able to attract the best and the brightest investors in the neighborhood. And so they have been providing a lot of resources to us in the form of advisors, financial supporters, board members that are really helping to cultivate the culture of our company. And I could say for us, our experience has been very, very positive and really gives us a lot of hope for how Boston is changing and the opportunities that are here in the city for bio-inspired, biotech, science-driven companies. We happen to play on both the side of science and beauty, which is very unique. And so we see this as a huge opportunity to be able to create more validated data in the design process, and to be able to have a group of investors to support this has been really the best part about it all.
And so, Layla, excuse me, I'm thinking also about sort of your target audience. One of the things that you talked about, or your target customer, at the beginning of this conversation was skin pigmentation and color. You know, one of the things that we have talked a lot about on the show over the last few years is how our white structures don't tend to build products that recognize and provide for the great variation in skin color in our human community. Is this a product that can work across all races, skin colors, skin textures? Is there a particular target market here?
Oh, I would say I'll answer the first part of the question, then Camille, I'll defer to Camille on the second part. But I will say that our material, we are championing the inclusivity of our material. So it is going to be something that any person of color will be able to use and be satisfied with. There is a gigantic gap in technologies for over-the-counter skincare products that are addressing some of the outstanding needs of women of color. And we believe that this is going to be a great solution to that, to meet that need.
Okay, now Camille, as you add on, you guys did bring a little bit of a product to try. Yeah. So I'm putting a little on my hand, and I should remind folks, I'm white. We were just talking about people of color in this product, but I am putting some of it on my hand. What am I putting on here?
So you're putting on one of my favorite day creams, which is just something for body. We're initially launching in the face category, but in our earlier days, we were trying to figure out, can xanthochrome even be incorporated in a formulation? And we landed on this really, really rich, buttery, velvety, soft cream that I really enjoy in my everyday experience as we're developing some of our other lines. But I can say that even though we're super, super focused on thinking about what are some of the unique needs for women of color, what we can see is that what we're learning about our products and how we're designing them can really be applied to the broader audience. And so for us, it's about being super intentional in our design, considering some of the skin types 3, 4, 5, and 6 that are sometimes follow-on areas of study or adaptations for brands, and saying, we actually want to prioritize these unique skin types. So looking at what are their hydration needs? How are we thinking about innovative ways to mitigate environmental factors like sunlight, like oxidation? What about some coloration issues, hyperpigmentations? How can we naturally be able to create products that address this with our ingredient? And how could some of the claims and the functionality of this be applied to a broader audience? So maybe you also are someone who's looking for a product that is addressing hydration, or you're looking for a new sun care. So now you are able to look to see what we have done with our C-Spire line and how you might be able to adopt this in your daily routine.
Yeah, I actually suffer from really serious dry skin, and this is it does have a velvety feel. The last piece that I want to pick up, and Layla, I'll come back to you for this. Do you think there is potential here to change the market? And if so, briefly, how?
Yeah, I do. You know, we're introducing a new raw material, and I think it's about really getting the people to engage with a new raw material that is going to do more than just a cocktail of what's been done in the past. So really disrupting the norm and getting in there and catalyzing a new movement for skincare.
All right. That is Layla Duravi, who is CTO of C-Spire, and Camille Martin, CEO of C-Spire, a new company launched here out of Northeastern University here in the greater Boston area. Thanks both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, grab your rubber boots and make sure that boat is big enough, because Massachusetts is entering great white shark season.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine. It's really a miracle of evolution. All this machine does is swim and eat and make little sharks, and that's all.
Do I really even need to tell you what that was? Richard Dreyfuss there in an iconic scene from the movie Jaws. So far, more than a dozen great whites have been spotted off the coast of Cape Cod, and the season hasn't even started for real yet. So here to talk more about what we can expect this season is our resident sharkspert, Greg Skomel, a shark biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Greg, it is always great to have you. Welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, and how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. It's good to be back.
This is sort of like Christmas for postal carriers for you, right? It's your busiest season.
Yeah, we're starting to get into it. It's the time of year when we initiate our intensive shark research schedule. So it's starting to ramp up.
All right. So you heard the clip we played at the top, and we'll talk a little bit later about the eye rolling that we often get from shark experts and shark advocates when we use Jaws. But for now, is that right? Perfect engine, eating machine, miracle of evolution, swims, eats, makes little sharks, and that's it?
Yeah, I guess if you really do boil it down to one sound clip, that summarizes it. I think Matt Hooper nailed it in that one.
Why do you love sharks?
Well, I'm fascinated by them. I have been since I was a child. You know, a lot of kids like sharks and dinosaurs, and I'm just one of those people that never outgrew that interest.
Okay, so everybody has their favorite dinosaur, right? Although mine has changed over the years. When I was a little kid, I wasn't that original. It was just T-Rex. But why the great white? What makes it special? What makes it fascinating? What makes it capture our imagination?
Well, I'm infatuated with a lot of different shark species, you know, and I'm still involved in research projects on a number of kinds of sharks, but, you know, white sharks have become really dominated my interest over the last several years because of their preponderance off our coastline and their seemingly growing numbers as they approach closer to shore. You know, they're an amazing top predator. You know, really a well-honed evolutionary success. And I think it's their size, their shape, their form, and the fact that, you know, albeit it's quite rare, they are known to bite people. And I think that draws a lot of fascination.
Well, you know, you use the word preponderance, you know, off our coastline. You said they're seemingly growing numbers. And this is why we have engaged with you every year around this season, Greg, to talk about sharks, both to educate people and to make us aware of the situation we're in. I want to cue in on a couple of things. We've already seen a dozen sightings off of the Cape Cod area, earlier sightings landing in May. You said seemingly growing numbers. So are there more sharks, or does it just seem like there are more sharks?
Well, it depends in what context we're talking. If we're talking about the population in general, you know, and the population spans the entire eastern seaboard of the U.S. and Canada, we think, based on the best available data, that the population is rebounding from very high levels of exploitation that occurred, you know, in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And so the population is coming back after some levels of protection were put in place back in the late 90s. When we talk on a more local scale, you know, we're talking about, you know, the coastline of Massachusetts. You know, there has been an increase in the number of white sharks approaching our shoreline over the span of the last decade or so. You know, how those numbers are changing from year to year are really difficult to quantify, you know, because it's a dynamic population. But we do know over the course of the last decade or so, more white sharks are approaching our shorelines and therefore are being seen each year. And they're doing so because of the changing seal population and the fact that they're coming closer to shore to feed on seals. And so we really have to put it into a quantitative context. It's really a difficult question for us to answer, but it depends on the scale of the answer.
And it's in part because of a successful, conservation story, Greg, right around those seals, where those populations have really, I don't know if exploded is the right word, but grown again after very intentional conservation measures.
Exactly right. You know, and seal populations were driven, you know, to the brink of extinction. And in 1972, we passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which has included seals, but also, you know, whales and dolphins, porpoises, et cetera. So as a result of now 50 years of protection, you know, seal populations are rebounding here off the northeastern United States and Canada. And so, you know, you bring back a prey species like seals, you're going to attract the predator. And the predator in our case is the white shark.
How safe are people on beaches?
You know, if we look at just the statistics, and, you know, that's what we do, you know, whether we're assessing risk of being hurt in a car or whether we're assessing risk of being hurt by an animal, you know, the incidence of shark attack is extremely low on a relative scale. And so one would conclude that the probability of being bitten by a shark is therefore extremely low. And it is, you know, from a statistical point of view, there are far more things. And we've all heard and discussed the analogies from lightning strikes to car accidents. You know, the probability of being hurt by a shark is very, very, very low. But I would want to also qualify that there are locations in Massachusetts where white sharks are feeding on seals, you know, through a natural predator-prey relationship, very, very close to shore. And in those areas, and this is in particular along the outer Cape, so the eastern shoreline of Cape Cod, where this predator-prey relationship is unfolding every day, you know, those are areas where one might want to consider the risk being a little bit higher than in other parts of Massachusetts.
All right. So we are seeing sharks early this year. When is shark season, quote unquote? And what do you make of the fact that we're having earlier sightings?
Well, I think the whole concept of earlier sightings is kind of a media made event, you know, and that's kind of what the media does, with all due respect.
Fair enough.
Even the dozen sightings that you are talking about, it, I'm unaware of. We've had a couple of incidents where white sharks have been seen by folks on the shoreline, which is exactly what we anticipate this time of year. You know, so all too often we use these sightings and they explode in the media and they snowball. But what we're seeing this year is really no different from what we've seen in previous years. White sharks begin to enter Massachusetts waters in May. The month of June tends to slowly ramp up. And then depending on how fast water temperatures warm. So the whole event is driven, the arrival of sharks and their departure is driven by warming and cooling water temperatures. And so it really boils down to the, you know, temperatures and how they're changing over the course of the spring and the fall.
And does that feed then into larger questions about warming temperatures in the ocean and climate change as well, Greg?
No, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. You know, we don't think it's going to dramatically change the distribution of white sharks, but we do see climate change impacting their arrival times, their residency periods, and their departure times. You know, as things warm up more quickly, white sharks are likely to arrive earlier. You know, and once the season is over and we can look at our tagged animals, which are close to 300, right? And we can see when they arrive, where they spend their time, and when they leave, we can begin to answer questions about whether this season, 2022, is different from other seasons. You know, but right now, we don't have those data in hand and won't until the end of the season.
So that dozen shark number came from reporting from NBC 10 Boston. And one of the things that's interesting to me is this Sharktivity app, which I have looked at. We've talked about it before. So cool. And it's a little bit of citizen science, too. It allows you to begin to crowdsource information about sightings. Tell us about the Sharktivity app.
Yes, the Sharktivity app is a wonderful outreach tool that the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy built years ago, and it's free to the public. It's obviously an app, and it's a great way for folks to learn about white sharks, to see where white sharks occur, and to also report white shark sightings as well. So it's a wonderful, you know, like I said, educational tool. But what I want to do is caution people is just because you don't see a white shark reported in a specific area, particularly along the Outer Keep, doesn't mean that they're not there. You know, so I'm a little hesitant to recommend it as for folks using it for a public safety tool. It really is a wonderful educational tool. And as you said, a wonderful way for the public to get involved in white shark sightings and learning about this species.
So duly noted, and we'll underscore that public education, public information tool, not the same thing as a public safety tool. Also, you added an extra dimension with Sharktivity this year, as I understand it, which is a confirmation or scientific review of the reportings. Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually something that's been going on a few years. It's something we try to do with every sighting. Is to confirm, you know, whether or not it is indeed a white shark that has been sighted. And who's doing that is my colleague, John Chisholm, who worked for me with the State Division of Marine Fisheries for many, many, many years and has retired, but has been doing this fact-checking in terms of identifying whether these are white sharks or ocean sunfish or basking sharks or, you know, floating debris. And he does a great job, and he's really excellent. And so it's to make sure that the information going out to the public through Sharktivity is validated to be true as best we can.
Meanwhile, you've got ongoing research where you are tagging sharks that you can reach, that come close to shore, that you can reach, and tracking them over time. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, back in 2009, actually in 2004, we tagged our first white shark. But in 2009, it really became more easier to tag white sharks because of their, you know, again, this really growing numbers off the Cape as they come close to shore. And we use a variety of technologies depending on the question being asked. And what we're doing over the course of the last couple of years is really looking at the behavior of white sharks over much finer scales. We're super interested in what drives their behavior close to shore, and specifically this predator-prey relationship they have with seals. You know, obviously, folks have public safety on the mind, and I don't blame them. You know, we had a fatal shark attack in 2018, and that's really gotten us thinking about how do we better understand their behavior close to shore, and how do we reduce the risk of shark attack? And so we're studying their really fine scale behavior using a couple of different tag technologies now.
So I want to do honor to the criticisms over time from shark advocates about the role JAWS has played. We use the JAWS quote and at the top of the segment. There's a lot positive about sharks, and we have some misconceptions. My sense from you is have a healthy respect, but don't revile these great whites, Greg.
Yeah, you're spot on with that. Absolutely. You know, this is a top predator in the ocean. You know, the ocean is a mix of species with a very complex food web. And think of the white shark and sharks in general as being those top predators fulfilling a critical role to maintain equilibrium or balance within our ocean ecosystem. And so, yes, they're scary creatures sometimes, you know, and JAWS absolutely exploded that concept and exploited it like Hollywood tends to do. But remember and educate yourself that these are, you know, another group of species in the ocean that we need. You know, we need our multiple, what we call trophic levels, from the very tiniest of ocean organisms that support the ecosystem to the big ones that cull the ecosystem. And so sharks are to be revered, respected, and understood better.
All right. That is Greg Skomel, shark biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tiziana. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks. And we will go out with more music from JAWS, but with a healthy respect for the fun of the movie rather than the misidentification of the role that sharks play in our community. And with that, that is our show today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. On behalf of our team, Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, Sydney Bowles, Sarah Leeson, Maya Schwader, Amy Moon, Marquise Neal, and Karen Schiffman, thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.